Okay, I know I enjoyed that break, meeting many wonderful people. Thank you, everyone, for your warm, nice comments. It really does help one another to feel the humanity, feel the love, and feel the mutual understanding. And we become great partners in life, and I appreciate everyone and your encouraging comments. Thank you. I think what I'll move on to now is just some prophetic statements of the Prophet Muhammad. And in Islam, our primary source is the Quran, and then the secondary sources are the explanations of the Quran, or additions to the Prophet explaining things in further detail. Those collections are kept separate than the Quran. So those are called hadith or prophetic traditions. And there are many, but I think for time and that we have a short time, I mentioned some things that were done to the Prophet Muhammad that he forgave others for. One incident was of a man who was actually trying to kill him when he was going around going around the holy house of Kaaba. He actually had a sword hidden and he wanted to kill him. And the Muslim story is that the angel Gabriel came and told the Prophet Muhammad that a person wants to do that to you, and he turned around to him. He's walking right next to him, and he said, Safwan, that was his name, what is it that you just told your own soul? What is it that you whispered to yourself? He said, nothing, nothing. And then he turned after a few times he asked him this, he said, didn't you just say that you wanted to kill me at this moment? And then he said, he took his hand and he put it on his heart and he prayed for him. And Safwan said that he was the most hated person to me in that moment, but he became, before his hand even lifted from my heart, he became the most dearest person to me. So you can see that, again, going back to those that want to harm you, it's very easy for us to slip into and hate them back. And again, you know, for us, I feel like we can relate to someone cutting you off and taking a parking from you. Right? That upsets us. I was at Costco a few days ago. My wife knows. I was going to make a right, and this person thought I was going to take the parking spot. I did have an eye for the parking spot. But he quickly went and got in, and instead he came on a weird angle, and then he had to go back and forth. And I let it go, and there was another beautiful parking spot opened up, and I parked, and as I was walking, he was still trying to adjust his car. So, I think we don't encounter, I thank God for this wonderful security we as human beings have, and I as a Muslim in this country, I mentioned that I am, as in the bio, I grew up here in Santa Barbara since I was in second grade when I first came, and I grew up here since. Sometimes I meet people and they say, are you happy you're here? And I say, absolutely. Because it's such a wonderful place. I met so many wonderful people. Santa Barbara is my home. My wife is from Vancouver, BC. That's another wonderful place. My second home after Santa Barbara. And at times I feel like it's my primary. Because it's another place. If you've never been, you want to take a vacation, go to Vancouver, BC. Whistler, the beautiful resort. It's just one of the best. But go in the summer. That's the only thing. I grew up here, and growing up here, I thank God for the things that I was blessed with. Like, for example, in Santa Barbara, I never felt discriminated against all my life when I was growing up. Of course, when I was in grade school, my best friend was an African American in the early, mid-80s. Yeah, you felt a little bit of racism, not as much now, but it was a little bit at that time still. You know, had to memorize the speech of Martin Luther King in fourth grade, and I still remember that you judge by the content of character, not by the color of your skin. And I would almost add, nor by the label of your religion, but by the content of character. I think that's the most important thing. And I thank God for that, and I pray that this security remains here in the U.S. and this type of love and respect between the greater Muslim community that are loving, peaceful people that just want to live life, where your doctors, pediatricians here at Sansom, and our engineers and others that have nothing to do with hatred and violence, but unfortunately, As my bio mentioned, that when we meet one another, when we sit and we eat together, is another thing I would like to add, is eating together. It gives a different perspective. And then we find we have our own human problems. We have our own individual problems that often relates to other people as well, regardless of what religion you follow. So just, I wanted to make that important side note. There's a tradition of the Prophet that says, show mercy on those on earth and you will be shown mercy from the heavens. In the Arabic it says, irhamu man fil ard, yarhamkum man fis sama. I have to say the Arabic because you might think I'm copying from the Bible. Reason why is, and I found this, Matthew chapter 5 verse 7, that says, blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. The famous sermon of Jesus, peace be upon him. So, it's the same. That if you do not show mercy, you do not forgive, you will not be forgiving. So that's, and what is actually important is, this tradition, why it's very important is because this is called Hadith al-Awwaliyya, the first prophetic tradition. Every student of knowledge learns first. I was blessed to hear this chain through an unbroken chain back to the Prophet Muhammad through my teacher Hamza Yusuf. And between him and the Prophet are roughly about 25 people. 1400 years, 25 individuals. Why? Because most of the scholars narrated this when they're around 80 years old to a 5-year-old. That if you don't know that it's all about mercy, then you have no understanding of the religion. And so this is why this is called Hadith al-Awwaliyya, the first prophetic tradition that you learn. It's all about mercy. So everything we learn as Muslims in Islamic law has to somehow connect with mercy. If it does not connect with mercy, it's cut off or it has a wrong understanding, right? So this becomes a very important. That's why I mentioned that, and it's beautiful that the Bible also mentions this. It's echoing the same. Back from Desmond Tutu, who mentioned the paradigm or model of faith is forgive one another as Christ has forgiven you. And this is exactly that. Forgive so that you're forgiven. It's very beautiful. Another example in the Quran that you also have in the Bible is the story of Joseph and his brothers. They did the worst things to him, and I'm not completely familiar with the Bible's narrations, but the Quran basically, you know, he was thrown in a well and they took his shirt and they put fake blood on it and they went to their dad, said the wolf ate him, and you know, and Joseph, when he was in the well, in the Quran it mentions he was angry at what his brothers did, but then God revealed to him that one day you will inform your brothers of this. And he's just a child, right? They say he's around 6-7 years old. He's just a baby, but as he gets older and his brothers come begging him because he was in charge of the stocks and foods and grains of all of Egypt, he tells his brothers at one point, do you remember what you did to Joseph when you were ignorant? And they said, Anta Yusuf? Are you Joseph? He said, I am. And this is my brother Benjamin. So he told Benjamin who he was, but he hid it from his brothers. After all that, the brothers said, you know, it is true. God did prefer you. And he did. Look at this. They had to come and beg him, in a sense, for food, because he was in charge of the affairs of Egypt. And because they had drought and famine. So they said, here we are back to you at your mercy. Well, look what we did. And Yusuf says to him, Joseph says, we call him Yusuf in Arabic. Joseph says to them, "La tathrib alaykum al-yawm." As I mentioned earlier, the Prophet said, there's no harm on you today. No harsh feelings. I've forgiven you. When they went to their father, Jacob, and said, Father, forgive us. He said, I've already forgiven you a long time ago. And I've already asked God to forgive you. Don't worry about it. Right? So look at the beauty. He didn't wait for them. He said, I've already forgiven you. In fact, Jacob in a sense knew they were lying about it, because Joseph told him a dream in the beginning and he knew it meant one day he will ascend to a great position, because he said, I saw the sun, the moon and the 11 planets. Right? This was before the astronomy. They're all bowing down to me. And then he said he understood that to be his father, mother and all of his brothers. Later in Egypt, at the end of his life, he said, Father, look, remember my dream when I was a little boy? He said, yes. He said, this is the dream that I had. He says, indeed it was. So, and Rumi, I'll end with Rumi. Some mentioned Rumi earlier. He has 7 advices that I thought were very beautiful. He says, in generosity and helping others, be like the river. Be like the river that flows. You don't care about who you come across. Help, be generous. And compassion and grace, or rahmah and mercy, be like the sun. Why? Because everyone benefits from the heat of the sun. We love Santa Barbara. It's another beautiful day in paradise as usual. I did enjoy the fog yesterday, and I enjoy coffee more when it's foggy. But after a coffee and breakfast yesterday, it was my birthday, and my wife, after it was over, we came out. Thank you. We came out, and when we were walking the sun, I said, okay, I did miss the sun. So the sun doesn't discriminate. I'm not giving my heat today to those that do wrong. I'm not giving it except to the Muslim. No, the sun gives its light to all. And so be like that in compassion and grace. In concealing others' faults, be like the night. As there's a prophetic tradition that if you, and this is not the topic, so I won't go too much into it, cover the faults of others, God will cover your faults in the next world. Okay. In anger and fury, be like the dead. Don't have any anger. Get rid of it. Once you die, believe me, or you're about to die. And one of the spiritual practices in Islam is to always be in a state of preparing for death. In other words, we're not, you know, you don't walk around society going, oh my God, I could die today. But don't hold feelings in your heart that if you were to die today, you're going to regret. And any of you who know, if you've ever met someone who's in the last part of their life, they have a different attitude. They don't hold grudges against anyone. They have so much love. And often a lot of people have a lot of regret. That, you know, I wish I could have lived different. I wish I could have loved people more. Or a dear friend of mine had a heart attack. One of my best friends from high school, and 25 years old. I said, how do you feel? He said, I have so much love for everyone. I don't hate anyone. His whole perspective changed. So in anger and all this, pretend that, you know, look at how the dead are. Be like that. Don't hold these grudges and hatred and things. It won't benefit us. Intolerance, be like the ocean. Yeah, you know, this is a metaphor also, to be like the bahar. It's the idea that there is no end to it. Especially amongst the Arabs in the old time, the ocean was the endless. You come to the shores, they didn't know how far it went. Right? And either you appear, and the last he says, either you appear as you are, or be as you appear. Either you appear as you are, or be as you appear. You know, so we have to be genuine of who we are. And we also have to yearn to be better. And I think we can all relate to that. In conclusion, before we take the questions, sometimes people talk about justice. That I want justice before I forgive. And I think I've kind of shown that in Islam, there's no need for justice in order to forgive. Justice is better, and it does help. And to be fair, there is an understanding in Islam also of the idea of justice, but if you forgive, it is a higher road. So it's a link in a sense between Judaism and Christianity. That if you wanted to take justice, a person has the right, because sometimes, unfortunately, that's the only way someone heals. But if you forgive and pardon, the Quran says that is the higher road, that is the better route. And that's what we as Muslims, we say in the beautiful teachings of Christianity, this is that higher road. And so, love also is at the core of forgiveness. If we don't have love, or we're deprived of that love, mahabba it's called in Arabic, hub for love for others, we're not going to be able to forgive. That the core has to be love. And finally, only when we have love and compassion, when we embody this reality, then it comes together to forgive. So, the Quran says about the Prophet Muhammad, he was not sent except as a mercy or as compassion to all the world. So with that, I end, and we can take the remaining time for a Q&A. And I think we have 15, 20 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I need a little setup for this question. First, after last year when you presented, I said I was ready to go follow you anywhere. And that resulted in a grace for me that I want to say and then ask the question. I've always had a kind of hardness of heart toward the Muslims or the Moors or whatever whenever I think of the map of Europe. Mm-hmm. You know, that's specifically like the early Middle Ages, 10th century, 11th century, 12th century, where all of north of Africa and Spain were conquered. And the grace I had was maybe they weren't, so to speak, conquered as by the sword, but that the message was so thrilling that they, you know, gladly embraced it. Well, then I started to think today we have sort of like a new idea of Christian missionaryism. Was it all that altruistic? Was it all that nonviolent, especially when we think of Africa? I myself grew up in colonies, so I know what that colony energy is. So this is the question. What is your view on evangelization? Well, that's the Christian word, I guess. What is your word toward spreading the faith, and where do you see dangers in the Muslims' urge to do it?
Great. Thank you for the question. Yeah. My answer would be chapter 2 of the Quran, verse 256. You can read it. La ikraha fi ddin qad tabayyana ar-rushdu min al-ghay. There is no compulsion in religion, for truth stands clear from falsehood. Everyone has a right to worship as they see fit. Now, I'm not going to say that Islamic history, everything was so wonderful and pretty, or any history, really. But what Islam teaches is there has to be a right of information to pass the invitation. The word to, in other words, call others to Islam in Arabic is dawah. Dawah means an invite. It's also the exact same word they use when they wanted to invite you for dinner or to a wedding. It's the same word. When you're invited, you have an option of not going. So my position is people who try to force others into a religion are committing a great wrong. And we saw in Egypt, for example, it took over 500 to 600 years before the greater population was Muslim. The majority were, and they're still, Coptic Christian. And Islam didn't go to knock down churches or anything else. Some of the caliphs at time committed wrongs, but Islam holds its values and its teachings from the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad. Those that violate it, well, that's on their own behalf, with God on the Day of Judgment. But Islam teaches that everyone has a right to live as they want, worship as they want, and that one actively should not go out to convert others. What Islam says is to embody the beauty of your own religion, right? And when people want, we can always educate, say this is what Islam says, but not to convert. The goal is not to convert. The goal, my concern is, as long as I present Islam correctly, whoever wants to reject it, I'll be happy in the sense that at least they know what they're rejecting. Because what we see in the media of violence, of extremism, of suicide bombings and kill the infidel and all this other, believe me, all Muslims are with the American public at large who believe this is barbaric, it's wrong, we have nothing to do with it. So in the sense, we're rejecting the same thing. That is not Islam. As for what Islam is, majority of the Muslim world still holds traditional values, and they're not capitulating to the ways of these extremists and terrorists and others. That really a population of 1.5 or 1.3 billion, the extremists are less than 0.01% still. And the majority of people ISIS is killing is Muslims who reject their ideology. One of my teachers, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, recently was in Turkey, who met a scholar who was beat and tortured by ISIS, but somehow was able to escape out. And this is what this, I don't know what words to describe the amount of how far they've strayed from the teachings of Islam. And also a scary thing that how does this occur? You know, this is what has really puzzled me and a lot of people. How do groups like this come out of nowhere? And worse than that, the most horrific thing, they're able to at times recruit people who live here in America. That scares me the most. So I've given my share of sermons condemning them at the most powerful way. Anybody who's been to a Friday prayer will see how I do things. Because I want everyone to understand that as far from the Islam that I follow. And the Islam that 99.9% follow. Political problems, issues of politics, that's a different matter. But Islam always says, no matter what is happening to you, you must respond in the ethical way and the teachings of Islam. You cannot resort to unlawful means at trying to, you know, the end doesn't justify the means in Islam. The means has to be correct, the end has to be correct. You must follow the path that is laid down by the Prophet, period. And anyone who goes away from that, like beheading people, killing... The Prophet said, whoever enters into our lands, like by visa and agreement, whoever kills them, I will be his advocate on the Day of Judgment. And whoever done that has turned away from his teachings and has been treacherous. And anyone who has a visa, anybody who's a journalist, anybody who's just anybody, you're not allowed to harm them in the least, let alone keep them as hostages and kill them. So this is a, you know, how do we forgive these kind of people? Well, in Islam, the way to forgive them would be to make prayers that they're turned away from the ignorance that they're in into the light. And by doing something, by teaching others. My job would be to make sure this ideology doesn't spread to anybody else. That what they're doing is incorrect. And we can prove it through the Quran, through the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, clear as daylight. Often people that go there are angry, they don't have a lot of Islamic education, and they're reading things just at face value. And I was pointed to a beautiful lesson about contextualizing and choosing which context, which interpretation you want to read. Most verses of the Quran that are, in a sense, problematic are in chapter 9 of the Quran, which most extremists use. But chapter 9 has a huge context in which most of those verses were talking about the Prophet's specific relation to the Quraysh and Mecca 1400 years ago. So they have nothing to do with keeping it general. And in Islamic law, there's conditions to when you can take the law into your own hand. What are the conditions? You never have a right to take the law into your own hand. It has to be a government, a proper government, not vigilantes like Al-Qaeda, right, and ISIS and others. They can do what they want and claim it's Islamic. But you know, like they say of Layla and Majnun, it's the Romeo and Juliet equivalent. Many people can say Layla loves me and I love Layla, but Layla says, I don't know who you are. Juliet says, I don't know who you are. You're not Romeo. These people can claim whatever they want of Islam, but Islam says, I don't know who you are. And that's my view. Yeah. Please, don't be shy. You can ask about anything you like.
Since most of these extremists seem to be the youth, it seems to be the young people are so attracted to this. There's this almost a longing to belong to this group. Mm-hmm. What is mainstream Islam doing to counteract or to attract the youth to the more positive side of Islam? And is there a way to do that?
Very good question. I think when we say mainstream Islam, it becomes tough because we have issues here in America. If we were to ask one another, many people, for example, are dying from certain types of diseases. What can we do about it in the medical field? We have tires that are made in a bad way that kill a lot of people. What can we do about it? When we say, what can we do about it, we have to look at the country and place that we're living in, the influence that we're able to have. For example, in Afghanistan, where I'm from, it's bad with the Taliban there. We're another extremist group. Again, reading things like at a kindergarten face value reading of the Quran is very wrong. It's all context and you have to read it within Islamic law. I feel that what I can do as a Muslim here in America is educate, is to speak with individuals, is to give them a sense of, once we educate others about what Islam is, and from my perspective, then we can say that when you are frustrated, when you have a difficulty accepting certain problems in the world, the answer is, what are you doing about it in the positive way that Islam allows? Right? So we would say, one of the philosophies I live by is, as long as I'm not the problem, this is one of the solutions. Because every individual in the end has their own accountability. And I think with youth and others that are going to these places, most of them are just frustrated by, you know, foreign policy. They feel like they're being singled out, oppressed. And so they want a way to help. And because they don't understand Islam doesn't allow by means of violence as they see it, it's very easy for them to just hear brainwashing lectures that quote scripture and they say, well, this is easy to do. Just go there and start killing or hurting other people. The more difficult thing is, go through the process. It's the democracy. You go and talk to individuals. You become a good example yourself and you educate others and you're patient. Another thing we didn't talk about is forgiveness and dealing with situations is all about patience. Right? And the verse that I read, that evil is not like good, repel that which is evil with what is better. And then at first, the next verse says, وَمَا يُلَقَاهَا إِلَّا الَّذِينَ صَبَرُوا. No one can do this except someone who is strength, who has a great grounding in patience. So it's about being patient. Now, we live in an age that, what is patience anymore? Right? We go into a line, if it's a 5-minute line, someone will pull out their phone and do something because they can't wait for 5 minutes. If a computer breaks down at a business, you see the frustration. What's going on? Oh, it's broken, I'm leaving. A long line. We don't live in a time of patience. And I know many of you who are older, I'm sure your idea of patience is very different from the youth today. So, unfortunately, we live in a time we want things now, we want it immediate, and we're not willing to wait. And so, what are Muslims doing? Yes, I feel not enough for sure. We are not doing enough. When you see, the Muslim ideology is this. When people are attacking Islam or saying these bad negative things, they say, well, I know it's not my religion and it's wrong. But what one gentleman once told me after I gave a lecture in a church is, he said, if you live on that philosophy, you're never going to change anything. He said, we, the Japanese Americans, we, some thought like this and we were discriminated. And we saw what happened after World War II. He said, but if you don't go out and you don't present what Islam is saying and you don't defend yourself, you're letting others speak for you. And you cannot be passive. And I saw a comment recently where one of the Muslims about Bill Maher, right? How do you say his name? Maher. Bill Maher, saying that Muslims are like this and Islam is like this. Some Muslims said, just ignore him, he's ignorant. I was very upset. I said, no, you cannot ignore him. For how long are we going to keep ignoring people like that? And just say, well, it's okay, ignore this, ignore that, ignore Fox, ignore CNN, little by little, little by little. You're going to avoid and ignore the whole world? No, you have to speak up. You see, with Jews in Nazi Germany, I'm sure it started similar. I mean, to give you an idea, as a Muslim today, I'm fearful. Because of everything going on, where is this going to go to? How far is it going to go before Muslims have a march, maybe 6 million people march in Washington saying, not in our name. This is not our religion. And we're not going to stand by it. We love being in America. We are American Muslims. We will defend this land. We will live in this land. We will pay taxes and deal with all that we all deal with. Bad health insurance, bad this, bad that. Hey, we're in it together. But this is wrong to just isolate a people and do that. And Muslims, they're still living passive. You know, and this cannot occur. And I talk about this every Friday, but Muslims, unfortunately, in my opinion, as a critique of Muslims, it's going to be the younger generation. Because the older immigrants, they came from countries that if you protested, you're in jails where they never saw you again. Like Egypt, like Saudi Arabia. These places, even if you gather to talk about politics, they'll lock you up. So they're, in a sense, bringing this back home difficulty here, so they don't know how to engage in a healthy way. There's no protest, there's no speaking out. Just leave me alone. I just want to be happy in my own little corner. But the younger college and other generation, they have to speak up. But most imams, I would argue, in this country, up until recent, has been the passive as well. They've been passive as well. You know, an open house at the mosque is as good as it gets. you know. And was this the attitude of African Americans when they were going for their civil rights? Right? This was not the attitude. There were a lot of movement. People stood up. Right? When Rosa Parks, right? Who said, you have to sit in the back of the bus. And no, I'm not. It takes people like that to stand up and say, no, I'm not. And we have to stand up and say, if this is what you claim Islam is, well, it's not the Islam that I follow, nor the interpretation that I and many others like me follow. This is a perverted and a misrepresentation of Islam. What one of my dear friends called Mislam, not Islam. It's Mislam. Yeah.
You mentioned the children, or the younger people in particular. And there's a big discussion going on now in interfaith circles about the transmission of faith. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I saw a statistic that something like only 20% of those who might be raised in a religious tradition by the time they reach adulthood are actually in it anymore. So are you looking at that the same way the Jews and the Christians are?
Yes, we are actually. This is also a very, very big problem amongst Muslims as well. There's a documentary called Unmosqued. I'm not sure if it's widely available everywhere. They've been doing studies on what is making the youth amongst Muslims also not come to the mosques. The mosque is not the only place where I believe Islam exists and practiced. There's a lot of Muslims that are very devout, but they don't necessarily go to the mosque. One of the reasons is because mosques at some places, and I'm sure some of you may relate in your own faith, maybe you don't like the preacher. Maybe you don't like the political association. Maybe you don't like the food. And I think the food here is wonderful. And I won't lie to you. I even told my wife this morning we didn't eat anything. I said, don't worry, they have really good food there. I think one of the problems we get with the youth here amongst Muslims and the problem is because there is a lot of challenges. And I think we have not had enough thinkers direct people on how to live as a Muslim in this country. Some things I've had to figure out on my own. You know, how do I do this as a Muslim in this country? Of course, this is the only country I've known mainly. I mean, I've traveled abroad a few places with my wife. I've been to Yemen. I've been to Saudi Arabia. I've been to Syria. Not good places to go when you're traveling at the border. They hold you up and ask you why you went to these places. But I went for pilgrimage and I went to learn Arabic language and I went to visit Sufi scholars, etc. But in my time growing up here, you know, it's difficult because you don't always know where do you stand on some issues. What is the right thing to do in the time and place that you're in? But I think one of the greatest scholars in the Muslim world, who President Obama recently in his UN address quoted, which is Sheikh Abdullah bin Bayya. He's actually the teacher of my teacher, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf. And to see him quoted at the UN, I said, oh, that's great. To me, that's a living scholar who understands Islam. And he understands the purposes of Islam. And he's the one, I believe, can defeat ISIS. As he said, we need more religion to combat religious people. Because the only language they know is religion. So by presenting them more religion of what it really says, you can perhaps change their mind. Therefore, we will bring peace with peace. So, you know, youth is a problem, and I'm sure at some point maybe we can have some kind of dialogue where we all get together and talk about if there's common things that we all need to do. Now, I'm not saying I, as a preacher, am not doing the right things as an imam, but we can all learn from common things, and then we can try to work on how to make that better. Maybe relevancy, maybe not listening to them enough. That would be a really nice program, I think.
I'd sort of like to speak to that, actually. I have a friend who's Jewish. She was my college roommate. She lives in Australia. She had this idea, mm-hmm. and she called it Project Abraham. And she said that the Christians and the Islam and the Muslims? Jews and the Muslims were all, they all saw Father Abraham as a common ancestor and common prophet, I guess. And what she did in Australia was that she got the three groups together, and they collected things. So they had like displays, and they kind of went on a road tour, and they went to various cities, and the government funded this as a project. And a speaker would come in from each religion, and people would come and sit down, and they would be able to see the things, and then they would actually have an interchange. And one of the things was there was supposed to be in each place some kind of project that occurred afterwards that all three groups, they were supposed to do together. And she did that for two rounds. She got two grants, and then her synagogue funded, gave her the room, and they continued to do it in the city of Adelaide, and now it's moved to the university. And they were actually using the same topic about forgiveness and things this year. But that's a kind of thing that, I mean, I would sort of like to do is to have... I don't know a lot of Muslims. I've known a couple in this city, but I don't commonly bump into them in my world.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be good that we all could speak. I mean, I know Judaism pretty well because I've known a lot of Jews. But the idea of Project Abraham is just an interesting way to do what you were just thinking about. I don't know how that might come to, but I'll just put that out there.
That's great. Thank you. Currently, actually, there are a few things going on in Santa Barbara. Some of the Muslim youth right now are working with the local Jewish community at Congregation B'nai B'rith. Rabbi Steve Cohen is a good friend of mine. We do a lot of projects together. We've had a private group called Torah Quran Study, in which myself and the rabbi and around three, four, five Jewish people would get together and discuss topics of how do you guys get married? How do you get a divorce? How do you guys celebrate? What are your celebrations? What does your scripture say about afterlife, et cetera, et cetera? And I went into it to really learn more about Judaism, because I felt a real need that I needed to learn more. Every time when I left the gathering, unfailed, I always felt a better Muslim. And I would hear from them, they felt like a better Jew. At one point, I remember we were so in a conversation, I couldn't believe what I was looking at. A couple of my Jewish friends were asking particularly my friend who is a good commentator on the Quran, really knows the Quran well, so why did Joseph go in the second time to prison? So that's why. And just seeing that discussion, it was like adding to the Torah what they were missing, a link, and it was like so in it. It was like there was no difference between what they were talking about, the Torah and the Quran. And that was a long process. And we do invite others at times to join that group. And recently, some of the youth from UCSB and others are trying to work together with Jewish students. But we need a lot of that. And it's been so healthy for Muslim individuals because they do have a sense of like, people don't love us, they don't listen to us. When they go to these gatherings and see that people want to listen to them and want to be heard, believe me, this is the future of Islam in this country. And for us to do this at this level, it is needed. And I think it will change the habit and behavior. They will go to their own communities and start bigger groups. And then those will be bigger groups. And then we will have more peace. This is the way to do it. So that's really great. Thank you.
I just had one comment that struck me from your presentation today, and it seems to be prevalent everywhere. But just this idea that... everything's so connected, whether it appears to be good or evil, there's a positive outcome available.
Mm-hmm.
And within that broader cultural context, I came across a thought that from the Tibetan, I believe, where there are cycles that, talking about patience, there, I think one of the shorter ones is 2,500 years, and called... a Kali Yuga, and apparently we're in the process of one of those now where it's a cycles of doing, of things coming together and coming undone.
Mm-hmm.
And when they come undone, it's stated that persons of exceptional incompetence hold positions of authority to help bring this about. And I found that personally very reassuring as a broader context that within our short lifespans, we're within these much broader cycles of time. And you touched on that many times today, that what is perceptibly, you know, out of sync may, within these broader cycles, have a very important formative
mm-hmm.
place because it gives the opportunity for the higher response.
That's right. Thank you. Beautiful. Thank you.
I'm going to go to this microphone and say to all of us, all of you, that we want to thank Imam Yama Niazi for his insights and his flavor and his enthusiasm for bringing about better understanding and deeper spiritual avenues for all of us. Thank you.
Thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
Peace and salam.
Salam. Salam. Thank you.
Happy birthday.